If we begin to give some credence to the idea that facts and opinions really aren't that far apart, it means that everybody can choose which of those facts they want. And I think we have to turn to the expert communities and say, all right, if 99% of the experts currently believe this, and there's some very small group who are not experts who believe this other thing, we can listen, we can discuss, but they're probably wrong.
You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, we are joined by evolutionary biologist and founder of the Clergy Letter Project, Dr. Michael Zimmerman. And alongside him, our hosts are
Ian Benz, Associate Professor of Elementary Science Education at UNC Charlotte. And if I had to pick to be an animal for a year, I would be a cat in this household.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. And if I could be an animal for 1 year, I would be a cicada while they're underground, just sleeping, because I'm so tired. And the thought about sleeping for 365 days sounds incredible.
I'm Kendra Holtmore, a PhD student at Boston University, and I would be a bird for a year. And I guess if I have to pick a specific bird, I'll just go with an owl. But being a bird for a year would allow me to also use the superpower that I would choose, which is to fly. And so I could, you know, have a trial run of flying while living as my animal before I have to answer the question about which superpower I want to have.
Rachel Jackson, rabbi at Agudas Israel Congregation, Hendersonville, North Carolina. And if I had to choose an animal to be for a year, I would be a unicorn.
Why didn't I pick that?
I was waiting
because
for you.
Because it's not real.
You could be a narwhal
instead. I said a unicorn. I didn't say which kind of unicorn. And
you might be able to.
You know what? I'm kind of an introvert, and being alone doesn't bother me in the least. So I'm okay with that part. I could understand the cross between mythology and real and magic, and really understand what it means to know that I exist and others to wonder about it. I just think that would be a fascinating sort of sociological exercise. Would be a unicorn.
Okay. So I think at this point, Michael, I will introduce you. You got your PhD in evolutionary biology from Washington University. You're a professor of biology and associate dean at Oberlin College. You then moved to University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. Again, professor of biology, dean, College of Letters and Science. Then you went off to Butler University, professor of biology and dean, College of Arts and Sciences. And then you just finished up a stint at Evergreen State College in Washington State. Member of the faculty, vice president for academic affairs. Your research experience that you've told me about is that you did do some research early on about the teaching of evolution, which is great. That's what we're talking about today. I know you write a lot for different newspapers. So syndicated newspaper columnist, book reviewer. Your honors and recognitions are pretty cool. You're elected fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And then winner of the Friend of Darwin Award from organization we're both very familiar with, the National Center for Science Education. And that's actually how I heard of you, was first interactions with National Center for Science Ed. And that's how I was introduced to the next thing, the Clergy Letter Project, that you are the founder and executive director for. It's an organization promoting an understanding between religion and science with more than 16,900 U.S. clergy members on board. So you've done a lot of really cool things. And what I kind of wanted to start us off with is I think, there'll be several listeners who are probably not familiar with the Clergy Letter Project. So I'd love for you to kind of talk a little bit about that. And then also too, while talking about it, kind of give us a little bit of background on why you started that.
Sure. Let me start with what it is first. It's a grassroots organization of, as you said, over 16,900 clergy members across the United States who believe that the teaching of evolution, a belief in evolution, doesn't conflict with with their religious beliefs at all. The goal of the Clergy Letter Project is for clergy members to come forward to demonstrate to parishioners that they can maintain their deeply held religious beliefs while also embracing the best modern science has to offer. What we see in America and unfortunately around the world is that there's this trope out there that you cannot accept both religion and evolution, that you have to choose between the two. And the loudest voices have said that you have to make that choice. Most religious leaders of most religious faiths understand that that belief, that forcing people into that dichotomous choice is just antithetical to their religious beliefs, to their teachings, to the doctrines of their religions. But that's not the common message. So what I was hoping to do when we started this project is to get religious leaders to stand up and say, hey, as a religious leader, I understand religion really well, and I don't have to choose. So you you as a believer, you in the parish, you in the congregation, don't have to make that choice either. What I discovered relatively quickly is there are lots and lots of religious leaders who felt that way, but thought that they were alone. They didn't want to come forward because they thought that all of their colleagues, and this was 15 years ago, and things have changed a bit since then, partly because of our efforts and partly because the world has changed a bit. They were just delighted to realize that there are other religious leaders who felt as strongly about the nexus between religion and science as they did. Going one step deeper, one of the things that I discovered very early on is when school boards try to modify their science curriculum by demanding that creationism in some form or religious doctrine in particular be brought into the science classes, people wanted to fight back. But the people who were most successful in fighting back were not the people that you would have expected to be successful. And by that I mean when a school board was taking action, often people would try to bring a scientist into the community and say why this action by the school board promoting religion in the science classroom was bad. And back in the 1980s, when people would come to me and ask if I would come to their school board and make a statement, I'd always say no. And I'd say no because you don't want somebody like me. And they said, what do you mean? So well, you don't want somebody like me who's boring. But more than that, you don't want somebody like me who's a scientist and somebody who's out of town. And they said, well, who do we want? I said, first, you want somebody local. And second, you want a religious leader, not a scientist. They say, but they're talking about science. I said, no, they're not. They're talking about religion. And if you have a religious leader saying, on religious grounds, I don't like this motion coming forward. I don't want this kind of material brought into the science classroom because it conflicts with my religion. This is somebody else's religion. It may be your religion, but it's not mine. We should be neutral with respect to religion in the science classroom. People are much more likely to listen. And that's why we collected literally thousands of signatures. The original Clergy Letter Project began in Wisconsin, where there was a board in a very small town, a town of about 1,200 people, who at this point, about 2005, I think it was, 2004, were promoting the country's most restrictive policy with respect to creationism in the public schools. And I mobilized religious leaders to combat them, and the world changed. For that community, at least. And then we went national, and we now have, as I said, over 16,900 clergy members who are willing to stand up and say, hey, we're not opposed to religion. My God, this is our life. But we're also not opposed to science, and we see how the two of them can work together. But they're not exactly the same thing. And if we're going to promote religion, we need to promote religion broadly and not one particular narrow perspective of one religious doctrine as opposed to the nature of religion itself.
Okay. Anyone else want to?
See, and I just made my point that the reason people don't want me to come in and talk is because I'm boring. And when I talk, nobody says anything. It shuts down all conversation.
I mean, I've known you for 25 minutes, and I don't think I would call you boring.
No, but it seems like 4 hours, you're going to say, right?
I would never say such a thing while it's recording.
You can.
So, I hear that refrain a lot, though, the not the boring part, but the I think I'm the only one part. That's one of the reasons why I felt so strongly that we needed to start a podcast, because mm-hmm. when we all came together in Sinai and Synapses, that was the overwhelming sentiment was, oh my goodness, I'm in a room with 15 other people who feel this way, and I'm used to being the only person in my entire sphere who does. And this is so nice and so refreshing. Mm-hmm. And you know, the fact that you've been able to get almost 20,000 signatures speaks to that too.
Well, I think you're right. There's more of this belief out there, but people first, as you say, think that they're isolated. And second, I've had people refuse to sign because they're nervous, because they know that what is so common is parishioners are much more conservative than clergy. And there are times clergy just don't want, they lead about some issues, but they don't want, I don't mean to be talking to clergy and telling you what you think. But many clergy don't want to lead on all issues. You have to pick and choose your battles. Yep. Absolutely. And that's important mm-hmm. to know.
Yeah. This is one of the ones that I've picked. And there are things that bother me that I don't even talk about because you only get so many issues that you're able to push on. That's just part of it.
Given that you've chosen this as an issue, what kind of feedback have you had in your congregation? Any?
Mixed. From the people that are opposed, I will often get silence. We're very nice out here in southeastern PA. Or I will get suggestions about articles that I should read, or somewhat passive-aggressive suggestions that, hey, pastor, I saw this and I thought of you. You should watch this video. And it's somebody talking about how evolution is wrong, or they'll give me a book or something like that. But often we don't have very confrontational conversations. I have garnered a certain level of trust with my people, and I think that goes a long way to helping them feel safe to express that, but also safe to listen to what I have to say, and how I always connect it into something scriptural or something that is connected to what we're actually talking about.
So Michael, I actually wanted to ask you, so I'm in a religiously liberal Jewish congregation, and the concept of evolution isn't a contentious one. It's a fact. And it's a fact as much as 2 + 2 = 4, where it's really a non-issue. And I was noticing on the Clergy Letter Project website, which that and many other things that we talk about will be in our show notes on our website, that there are, shy of 800 rabbis on there, quite a few UUs. Do you find that in religiously liberal congregations of any stream, of any religion, are more apt to sign on as opposed to those who tend to have a more fundamentalist, evangelical, literal read of whatever their scripture might be? Do you find that there is a marked difference?
It's a difficult question. One of the things that we've not tried to do, and I think I'm going to answer your question, but I'm coming about it from the back end, I think. One of the things through the Clergy Letter Project we're not trying to do is proselytize. So for people who are of a fundamentalist nature, regardless of what religion they happen to be a part of, if they are a biblical literalist, I'm not interested in trying to convince them that their particular take on religion is wrong, and they need mm-hmm. to change their worldview. Right. That doesn't seem to be my job. And I think if it were my job, I'd fail at it. So for many of those people who have a religious belief that is anathema to the concept of evolution, I have not been reaching out to them, asking them to sign. Now, going to the other side, people like yourself, perhaps, or in congregations that are truly liberal, there are times I have trouble getting them to sign for two reasons. One is they say, this just isn't an issue for me, for my congregation, so I don't want to put my name on this. Mm-hmm. There's an easy response to that I try to make. Sometimes I win people over, sometimes I don't. And if you want, I can go into that. The second part is the clergy letter, the rabbi letter, that we have 5 different clergy letters based on denomination. Mm-hmm. They were all written by a clergy member in that denomination. The rabbi letter talks about stories in the Bible. And there are people who say we take it seriously, or what I don't have it in front of me. There have been some rabbis who say, you're giving too much credence to the Bible. We don't, I can't endorse the seriousness with which the letter ascribes meaning to some of these stories. And therefore, I believe science and religion are perfectly fine. Judaism has no problem with evolution, but the letter itself is too conservative for me to endorse.
Right. Right. I mean, and I think the line that you're looking at there is in the second paragraph, the Bible is the primary source of spiritual yes. inspiration and of values for us, which I can certainly hear that as a more conservative line.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I'm just scared to move my computer around because I know I'll disconnect things. So yeah. That's why I don't have it in front of me. But yeah, that's exactly the line that people have objected to. And you know, when you have a letter that's been written by somebody who's a rabbi and talked with others and they decided this is what they're going to go with, once you have 15 people on board, you can't change it. Then once you have 600 people on board, you really can't change it either. And that's the framework we're stuck with. So some people have refused to sign for that reason as well. What I've tried to do is explain to people, even if every word doesn't resonate with you, and I'll come back to something as a scientist that does not resonate with me in these letters, but I've come to appreciate. What I've said is it's important that together we send a message to those who aren't as sophisticated as you to demonstrate that religious leaders and scientists, that the religious community and people who just appreciate science can come together. And by saying that we as religious leaders or you as religious leaders can endorse something like this has a power unto itself. Mm-hmm. Now, in all of these letters, the first letter that was written was the Christian clergy letter, and it talks about the nature of truth, and it talks about scientific truth. And as a scientist, I believe there is a truth out there, and there is a scientific truth, but as a scientist, I know we will never know when we find that truth. Our goal is to look for it and to get closer to it and to get closer to it, but always to remain open that the next experiment may teach us something that contradicts what we've known before, and we have to then alter how we view the world to some extent. Now, major paradigm right. shifts don't happen that often, but they occur suddenly sometimes. So I was uncomfortable with the word truth until after about a year of working with all of these religious leaders and embracing the clergy letter, I've come to recognize that in that sense, truth has a slightly different meaning. It's the same meaning that so many words in religious texts can be read as, and that is his metaphor. It means something bigger than just the lowercase truth we talk about.
The reason that I was asking that question is one of the conversations that we've had really throughout our conversations on this podcast is communicating with one another in our echo chambers and just sort of looking at how do we come out of them and do we want to come out of them? So I think what you were just talking about highlights those conversations as well.
Basically, my question for you, Michael, is that in hearing about your public role and involvement in trying to educate people about the way in which religion and evolution can be harmonious or coexist, it makes me curious to hear a little bit more about your personal story and your background and upbringing and just like all of those factors that bear on the work you do now and how that like inspired you to do what you do now.
Sure, happy to talk about it. Although I want to make one thing clear, and that is, with the work of the Clergy Letter Project, what I try as hard as I can to do is focus less on me and more on the clergy members who are involved, because it's their message that is important as opposed to my personal message. I am not a clergy member, and therefore, when I speak, I'm speaking as just an individual, not somebody who carries the weight of religious conviction in the way that a clergy member does. I came to it with a PhD in biology. I was teaching biology at Oberlin College back in 1980, when in late 80, early 1981, there was a major trial in Arkansas It was, I don't know if you all are familiar with that trial or not, but it was a trial dealing with legislation that was passed in Arkansas demanding that whenever in any public school in the state, whenever evolution was taught, creation science, as it was known at that point, had to be taught as well. And it was really the first major creation trial or evolution creation trial in quite some time. And it was probably the most important since the Scopes trial, I think it's fair to say. There were some other issues along the way, but this was the most important since the Scopes trial. At that point, I had never, I grew up, I had a PhD in biology. I had never heard of creationism and creation science. Never thought about it, didn't know a thing about it. Accidentally, for some reason, the ACLU, which was litigating the case in Arkansas, got a hold of me and asked me to review some documents. I want to be very careful about what I say here, because those documents were rather trivial. They played absolutely no role in the trial, but they transformed my life. There were people who were much more well-educated, much more knowledgeable, and much more important who were involved in the trial than I was. And to say I was involved in the trial is a gross exaggeration. But I read these papers, published papers, all published in the creation literature, that the ACLU gave me. I wrote a report for them, and I was blown away by what I was reading. And that was the end of my involvement. But I started reading more, and I started realizing what was happening in schools, and I started writing and speaking out about the topic. And I became much more immersed in that controversy. I did that for about 10 years, and I got bored. I got bored, and I got frustrated. I apologize for going on at length, but let me give you one example of what turned me off completely. During that time, during that 10-year period, I became the editor of a thing called the newsletter for the Ohio Center for Science Education. It was an offshoot of the National Center for Science Education in the state of Ohio. We published a quarterly newsletter, and on the front page of every one of those quarterly issues, I put up a major example of creationist misinformation, explaining what these people were saying and why it was wrong. But before I published that in the newsletter, I always went back to the people who I was critiquing and said, here's what I plan to write. How much space do you want to write a response? You're welcome to, I will publish anything you want to say. Nobody ever took me up on that offer. Yeah, that was the first part. The second part is, towards the end of that time, I think it was Henry Morris, who was then the president of the Creation Research Institute, who I was critiquing because he was writing and he was regularly speaking about Stephen Jay Gould, and he was quoting Stephen Jay Gould. And whenever you quote anybody in oral arguments or in writing, you have to use ellipses. That is, you can't quote everything they say. You have to take out some words and put some things together. And you know, you have an obligation to do that fairly, but it's not unreasonable to not present every word they've ever said, especially somebody who's as prolific as Stephen Jay Gould. What Morris was doing was taking out just one word from one particular paragraph, and he was doing it regularly. And the word was a fairly important word, because the word was not. Mm-hmm. And that you take the word not out of a sentence in a paragraph, and it changes the meaning.
Yes.
Now, everything else the man was saying was an exact quotation of Stephen Jay Gould. So he was, you know, being perfectly honest about that part. When I published that piece, and it didn't change a damn thing. That is, he kept going on making exactly the same arguments. I got tired and I took a sabbatical. I took almost a 10-year leave from being a public spokesperson about this issue. I moved to Wisconsin, and all of a sudden I received a phone call. I think it was a phone call. It might have been an email from somebody saying, do you know what's going on in Grantsburg, Wisconsin, and what do you plan to do about it? And I said, well, I've never heard of Grantsburg, Wisconsin. I don't know where it is. I don't know what's going on. And I'm sorry, but I don't plan to do anything at all about it. And then we got into a deeper conversation. And what I realized is what was going on in Grantsburg, Wisconsin, was crazy legislation being adopted by the school board and a bunch of people in the school district, professionals in the district, doctors, lawyers, vets, a bunch of people wanted help combating this runaway school board. And that's how I got truly interested again in fighting creationism. But I come to that work because I care about science education more than I, at that point. I knew very little about religion, to be honest. I mean, I grew up in America, but I wasn't a deeply religious person. I cared about science education, and I could see what was happening with this promotion of one particular religious perspective was doing great harm. It was doing harm to science education, and it was doing harm to most mainstream religions. So as I got started down this path of working with clergy members, I became much more, I'm still poorly educated about religion, but I've become better educated than I was. I developed a much deeper respect for the work of clergy and realized that the damage that was being done was as equally damaging to religion as it was to science. And I then basically adopted this as my full-time hobby. And when I'm not doing anything else, this is the work I do because I care about both. But it's because I think science education is really important to a democratic society. And as I said at the very outset of when we were talking as a group, we no longer believe that expertise matters. And once you dismiss expertise, you're dismissing science. And that's really dangerous for us making rational, coherent decisions about the future of our planet and our society and our country.
Yeah, how do we reclaim that, the trust in expertise?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Michael?
In 12 words or less.
Yeah, it is a great question. If there is a simple answer, we would have found it a long time ago.
Ah, touche.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things we all have to do is push back regularly about all forms of expertise and accept it and recognize it and praise it when we see it and differentiate expertise from elitism. Because, you know, we say we don't like elites. Well, I believe in some form of elitism. I have the good fortune of being an elite. That is, I am very well educated. I'm lucky. I've worked hard for that to happen, but I've had lots of breaks. If more people were well-educated, I think we would have a better society. It doesn't mean everybody has to go to college, but people need to be well-educated, and there are lots of different ways for that education to take place.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, the way you got involved, even though our backgrounds are different, because my background is in science ed, not, you know, I did get an undergrad in environmental science, but I was never a practicing scientist. I was a teacher, a high school science teacher, but now PhD in science ed. But it was, I started getting involved because, you know, it was during the Dover trial in 2004, 2005. And I was just fascinated by the arguments used against the teaching of evolution and the promotion of teaching of intelligent design up there, and realizing that many of the arguments stemmed from people not understanding what science is. So to me, it was outside of, do they understand evolution? I just kind of quickly realized these people just don't recognize what science is. And so, like you talked about earlier, you know, with the letter and having the word truth in there, that as a scientist, you recognize there's always a possibility for some new information to come out, which could change our current understanding. What I find fascinating is that the people who sometimes will argue against the teaching of evolution in schools will say that, well, since that's the way science works, that's why we can't trust science at all. He'll take that to the other extreme. Have you heard that before? Or?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They say that in practice. They don't believe it in principle, though. Because
right.
they very rare. I mean, what's a fascinating aspect of that is we as scientists, especially physicists, recognize that we know more about evolution than we know about gravity. That is, there's just a huge amount of the inner workings of how gravity occurs that we don't understand. And yet, very few people argue that the theory of gravity is just a theory and we don't care about it. They won't take the arguments that they make against the theory of evolution and apply it to gravity, even though we know less about it. At one level, I believe the concept of evolution is so central to biology, it's important that we understand it. I care about evolution because I care about biology, but in fact, that's rather the trivial part of why I fight this battle. I fight this battle because if we dismiss, and you said it so well, if we dismiss evolution on the grounds that it's not scientific, what we're doing is dismissing science. We're misunderstanding right. The nature of science, and mm-hmm. therefore we're educating students in a way that precludes their understanding of an important aspect of the whole scientific worldview.
Right.
And that is deeply damaging, whether you care a whit about evolution or not.
Well, and for them to recognize that as you also said earlier, that the disservice that individuals who are fighting against the teaching of evolution in schools, that they're doing a major disservice to both science and religion, in my opinion. They're presenting, which, you know, all of us here advocate for, you know, having the dialogue. They're presenting the either or argument that you either can accept evolution, and if you do that, you got to throw away anything there is about religion, or vice versa. And they don't recognize that both of those fields contribute to society and in their own ways.
Ian, you a couple minutes ago referenced intelligent design, and I have a question for Michael, but first want to, for the sake of our listeners, say a little bit more about what intelligent design means over and against like other forms of creationism, because a couple episodes ago we talked about the difference between like young earth creationism versus old earth creationism, but didn't really talk much about intelligent design in that conversation. And it, I think, is really important for us now in this discussion about like teaching evolution in schools, because intelligent design really like became a popular phrase after the 1987 Supreme Court ruling that it was unconstitutional to teach creation science in schools, but that schools could teach secular alternatives to evolution. And so this sort of like opened up a can of worms where people started saying that like intelligent design could be an alternative to evolution. And it was touted as this secular alternative because really the basis of the argument doesn't require anyone to rely on the Genesis creation accounts in the same way that young earth and old earth creationism do, because intelligent design just says that all life is created and guided by an intelligent cause. And this is so, we know this because life has irreducible complexity and that this could not have just happened by chance. So that's like the crux of the argument. And so technically it looks secular, but it was accused as being this sort of like undercover religious agenda to get creation science back in to public schools. Mm-hmm. And so intelligent design has been controversial for that reason, as people fight about whether or not it's actually a secular alternative to evolution that deserves to be in public schools, or this like religious agenda that we need to continue to ignore as we have done for other forms of creationism. And so I'm wondering, Michael, in your experience, do you see people having conversations about intelligent design in this way? Like, do people just, I think sometimes I hear people use intelligent design as this sort of catch-all category, but I think it is important to distinguish it from other kinds of creationism, depending, like if you're having a really specific conversation about policy, for example. So I'm just curious how you've heard people use this term, intelligent design.
Good question. I think it's been used in a number of ways, a wide variety of ways, many of them probably far from its original and intended meaning. The Dover trial that was referenced before gave a very clear ruling, a shockingly clear ruling, that intelligent design is, in a legal sense, a religious doctrine and cannot be taught in public schools. And it's for that reason that we don't see intelligent design being promoted in schools any longer. We see something a little bit different. From a religious perspective, you guys can address this better than I can, but it does damage to some people's religious beliefs to say that intelligent design is the way the world works. From a scientific perspective, however, it's even worse. And the part of intelligent design that's really, really problematic scientifically is the piece that you said at the very end, that is irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity is a subset of intelligent design, but it's at its core, it says there are some pieces of the natural world around us that are so complex in and of themselves, they couldn't have come about through natural forces. They had to be created by some designer. And when we talk about a designer, what could a designer be other than a god? Now, if you believe that there are some things that are so complex that they could not have evolved in a biological sense, once you define what something is, a behavior, a physical characteristic that's irreducibly complex, if you're a scientist, what are you supposed to do with that? You're supposed to say, well, science is over. We know that this is irreducibly complex, so there's no more science to be done. And for anybody to call for an end to scientific investigation because we know the answer now is exactly the antithesis of what scientific investigation is all about. Let me make two quick points. One is the two, if you will, poster children for the intelligent design movement for the concept of irreducible complexity are flagella on bacteria, that is the tail at the end of them that fluctuates so they can move around their environment, and the blood clotting enzymes that allow blood in mammals to clot so we don't bleed out. If you don't have the right blood clotting enzymes and you're a human, you have hemophilia, and that's really dangerous. In both of those cases, scientists have said, proponents of intelligent design, irreducible complexity, have said, you see, take away any part of this, and the whole situation doesn't work, and therefore it had to be designed in situ in exactly the way it is that we see it now. The problem with that is scientists have done lots and lots of experiments and found there are lots of steps that lead us to where we are today. There's nothing about these poster children that are irreducibly complex. And again, I come back to what I said at the very beginning. If anyone is to say, I know the answer, no longer investigate. The answer is this. Don't waste your time looking into anything about this. Unless, of course, it's a conspiracy theory. What that says is you're not doing science. You're saying, I have found the truth, and the truth is as I've set it forth. Accept it and move on. That's not science.
And it's so dangerous from a religious perspective that Adam had brought up a couple of weeks ago, the Ship of Theseus thought experiment, right? That you replace a bit of the mast, you replace a bit of the hull, and then by the time you get to your destination, you've replaced every bit of the boat. Is it still the same boat? That what you're essentially doing with that kind of an argument in intelligent design is saying, okay, so this plank is what makes this ship, and everything else can change, but this plank is it. But then the moment that you discover an explanation for why this flagellum exists or whatnot, then you've replaced that plank, and now you have put out the criteria by which you can disprove the existence of God.
And that goes back to the original God of the gaps theory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, God is just there to explain the things we don't know, and as we know more and more, God takes a smaller and smaller role. If that's the religion you want to profess, that's, you know, it's a very narrow religion that doesn't have much currency, I don't think.
No, less and less every year.
Yeah. But let me go back to something that I think it was you, Zach, but it may have been somebody else. I don't remember who said it. But it was going back to the Dover trial that, in fact, the reason the Clergy Letter Project went national was because of the Dover trial, because the Dover trial happened right after the situation I was talking about in Grantsburg. And I thought, if we could take the signatures we got in Wisconsin National, we could make a difference. But more than that, one of the important things that you said about this, what was going on in Dover and elsewhere, is we weren't having, and what I think it was, must have been Zach who said, you're able to have conversations in your congregation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that's so important, because it's one of the things we're trying to do with the Clergy Letter Project, is to deal with complex issues in a civil sort of way. Mm-hmm. In the Dover situation, there were fundamentalist ministers who were always on television basically saying, if you believe in evolution, you're going to hell. That was their argument. Now, that argument may be true. I can't disprove that it's true. But even if it's true, it doesn't get us very far. We ought to be able to say, hey, I believe this and you believe that. Let's have a dialogue. Let's do it in a way where I can listen to you and I can respect you and I can disagree with you and I can present some evidence why I disagree with you, and you can do the same instead of just calling each other names. And if we can do that, and if we can do that about a complex issue like creation and evolution, religion and science, can't we do it about other really important issues in our complex society? So the issue becomes, can the debate about religion and science be a model of how we can have really complex debates in society about ethnicity and race and homophobia and Islamophobia and just huge differences. We can disagree about some things and still discuss them instead of just pointing fingers and calling names and being rude and being non-civil.
Which is exactly the reason why, after our introductory series, the first mini-series we did on this podcast was about the separation of church and state. Was we wanted to take on something that was controversial and that makes people mad to help to hopefully model what a constructive conversation looks like. That's one of the reasons, one of the things we hope comes out of this podcast. Hopefully one of these days we'll get somebody on who has fundamental disagreements with the way that we see the world, and then we could really put that into practice. Keep saying, Ken Ham, if you're out there and you want to come on the show, you are more than welcome.
Yep.
So what it seems like it boils down to is it really is about relationships, and each one of us is trying to take a piece of the world as we see it and increase the respect and kindness and curiosity within those relationships that we have the power to do so in order to create a better world. And so, Michael, it seems like your piece of this kindness pie is with the clergy letter. It's going to be a new flavor one of these days. And how that can then increase our awareness of one another. And one thing that we in this internet age need to be very aware of and careful of is clickbait headlines. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about these different trials in Wisconsin and Arkansas, and the latest one that we'll add in 2019 is Ohio and the law that was just passed there. I don't know if it's law. I'm not a lawyer.
It hasn't been passed yet. It's not law. House, but not the Senate.
Thank you. I didn't know where it was tripping up, and hopefully it'll just fall flat on its face.
As of November 21st.
That wasn't kind. Now, the clickbait is this idea of, you know, students are going to be allowed to say whatever they want on their science exam, and it'll be a religious exemption and, you know, end of story. But if you look at the very nuance of this very long legalese paragraph, it doesn't quite say that. So for those of us that are neither clergy, nor lawyers, nor scientists, which is a lot of people, how do we understand something like that, where, you know, we might have kids in school and we'll be like, oh no, what is actually going to happen? Or we're a teacher and we don't know how we're supposed to then handle this if a student says something, right? How do we react? Again, not the instantaneous reaction of, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. It's 2019. Why are we still having this conversation? But the second reaction, which is a little bit calmer and perhaps less emotionally tied. So anyone want to pick up there?
Well, so with the Ohio thing, and so if people aren't aware, what happened with Ohio mid-November, early to mid-November, was the Ohio House passed what was called the Ohio Student Religious Liberties Act. And so I don't know all of the details around it, but the clickbait that you were talking about, Rachel, is that people were saying, oh, well, because of this, the student could write down in a science class that, you know, when talking about like evolution, for example, that they could say that they don't agree with evolution because of their religious values, and then they couldn't get graded down for that. I reached out to contacts at NCSE to ask for more information to see, you know, did they have anything on this or not? Because what I had noticed at first was is that they had not addressed it at all on their site. And then I learned that the reason why they didn't address this is because it actually doesn't really directly deal with science education. And that it seems like, and I learned this over the past few days, that apparently other states have passed this type of stuff, and it is law. In Ohio, from what I understand, it most likely will not make it into the Senate. I don't even think it, as of yesterday, it's not even been assigned to a committee in the Senate. So anyway, I know I'm rambling. I'm sorry. The idea here is that from what I understand, it will not, you know, students are still expected to have the right information. I think the concern that I saw from it, though, and this is based largely on my experiences in Louisiana, was trying to figure out, is the language included in that particular bill, is it some sort of code language like we see with the Louisiana Science Education
Act? Exactly.
Language, right? And so you asked about, you know, how do people know what to do, or you know, who are not experts in those particular fields and legal and all that kind of stuff. And what I did was, is I reached out to NCSE, who has that expertise, and said, what can you tell me about this? Just like when I was in Louisiana and I had to testify against bills down there, I reached out to them and said, this was, you know, brought, I reached out to NCSC and said, my dean brought this to my attention about a textbook bill. Can you please look this over and help me better understand it? Because I don't have the knowledge and expertise around all that. So I think that's where people get the help. But the issue is that they need to know where to get the help. And that's one of the reasons why, Michael, bringing you back in, why I really like the Clergy Letter Project, is that it was during that time of testifying in Louisiana back in 2010, 2011, when I really started to take interest in the Clergy Letter Project and learn more about it, because, you know, I knew that, and I know now, still know that science is not out to get religion. And I knew that we needed to have religious leaders supporting our efforts and testifying so that people would think that, or would recognize it's not something out to get religion. So that's what I loved about the Clergy Letter Project, is that I could refer to that in testimony, you know, and just bring up those numbers to show that this is not an atheistic endeavor. This has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. This is about science, right? So, but I had to do the work. I had to find out where to go.
Now, one of the things you say that so nicely and so well, one of the things that's important to remind people is when we teach evolution, never, at least I don't know anybody who on a test or in class wants people to say, yes, I believe in evolution. They ask people, do you understand what evolution is? Do you understand what the scientists are teaching us? You don't have to believe it personally, but you need to understand it. And if you want to critique it, wouldn't it make more sense to critique it from a knowledge base than to critique it from a position of ignorance? So the belief that some fundamentalist religious communities have that science education is proselytizing an atheistic worldview and is trying to convince people that they have to believe this instead of that is just terribly mistaken. And if we can better educate people, and here's a task for all of us, if we can better educate people about the value of education broadly, let alone science education, that the more you know, the better off you are, that's a good thing. And that it's good to know what humans think are facts as opposed to only what humans think are beliefs. And there's a difference between belief and fact.
And as you said, I mean, we see that rising now with, you know, conversations with history and conversations around the Civil War and slavery. You know, it's mind-boggling to me, some of the conversations that I see and hear from people when talking about the Civil War and history and how, Civil War and slavery, and how slavery really didn't have a lot to do with it. And I'm just kind of looking at it and thinking, what do you mean it didn't have a lot to do with it? And then what they'll say is that, you know, after that, when I point out, well, no, you know, no, we understand pretty clearly that it did was kind of a big part of the Civil War. The response that, you know, I get from a lot of people is that, oh, well, that's just from some, you know, that's just from a bunch of liberal progressive, you know, history professors in ivory towers. That's not really the truth. So then you attack the character of the individual and you add a political perspective to it. And then what? Right. So,
yeah, I think when I hear, you know, beliefs and facts, it still makes me uncomfortable, because when we teach facts, we still teach with our bias. And so my 5-year-old is in kindergarten, and it's Thanksgiving, which is a secular holiday, so they can really ramp that up in schools, right? Like, they can actually go to town with that one, and no one can get offended, except I totally got offended. when he brought home, and I'm using the words that the teacher was using, an Indian wearing a feather.
Oof.
Oh.
Yes, Zach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is not really what we're teaching. This is, it's not facts. And then he brought home a bracelet which showed the trip of the pilgrims and how they helped the Indians. And I went, oh, that's so not okay. That's not fact, right? That's one very misinterpreted understanding of what happened. And so I again, as a scientist and as a clergy person, I do believe in facts, but I'm also very wary of how we change facts over time because we get more information. We become more considerate and more respectful of the peoples we're talking about. And we can talk about, you know, like Ian brought up the Civil War and the mistake of what it was all about, the Holocaust deniers, the fact that there's not a requirement to actually teach about the Holocaust in schools, and that there are teachers still in this country who say, well, we can't prove that it happened. So I get very worried when we talk about facts, because again, it goes back to authority and it goes back to the relationships that you have with authority. And if someone is telling you that it did or did not happen this way and you put all of your trust in them, then how do we have that conversation? How do we, right? So if he is really the poster child, so we're definitely picking on him. How do we talk to Ken Ham, right? As the example. So I get very nervous when we talk about just the difference between belief and facts, because again, as a scientist, a theory is correct until it's proven otherwise. And that's a place, like that's a comfortable place for me to be. And that's not a comfortable place for many people to be from a sociological standpoint.
But I think, again, you say that so nicely, and it's there's a real tension there, because it's a real tension. The challenge is, for me, I guess it comes back to what I've been saying throughout this entire time we've been together. Expertise matters. And when the clear majority, the entirety of an expert community comes down on one side of an issue, again, it doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it may not change in the future as we know more, but we have to give added weight to that perspective. And if we don't value fact, and I don't mean to say you're doing this, I want to be very careful. I'm not criticizing you in any way at all, because what you're saying is so heartfelt and so correct. But if we begin to give some credence to the idea that facts and opinions really aren't that far apart, it means that everybody can choose which of those facts they want. And I think we have to turn to the expert communities and say, all right, if 99% of the experts currently believe this, and there's some very small group who are not experts who believe this other thing, we can listen, we can discuss, but they're probably wrong. Now, that, again, that doesn't mean there aren't paradigm shifts at times. But what I say in a trivial way, when people criticize me for my belief in evolution, saying, well, you have a PhD in biology, therefore we shouldn't listen to you because you're biased. Mm-hmm. I get that criticism quite a bit. I say, all right, I can accept that my bias in my education is colored my view, and you may know as much as me, but I'll respect that opinion only when you need open heart surgery, when you go to your accountant for that. And rarely do people say, you know, I'm going to go to that accountant. It might be cheaper anyway.
I mean, I get that too. And, you know, as having my PhD in science ed, you know, I have gotten the same thing too. Well, you know, you're biased because of your PhD in science ed, and you know, mm-hmm. I'm not asking for, you know, red carpet treatment or anything like that. That's not it. It's just, I just find that very interesting. And what's been the most interesting, and this hasn't happened since I was in Louisiana, but when there, I was dismissed because of the fact that I have a PhD. But then you had people from I think it was Louisiana College, which is a religious college. And when you would have professors from there who have a PhD in something, their PhD was welcomed. And it was because of the fact that even though they may have had a PhD in a science, it was still welcome just because of the fact that they were at Louisiana College and it aligned with the perspectives of the people on the committee.
I leverage that from time to time, knowing that people will trust me more on issues of science because I'm not a scientist and I'm a clergy person, to just elevate the voices that know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten critiqued because I'm a seminary-educated clergy person who has lost their soul because they went to seminary, and you should really be trusting those who didn't, because Jesus was followed by, you know, a bunch of fishermen who weren't religious elites and all of that. So it goes both ways. It's unfortunate, and it makes my job more difficult. But we are at the end of our time together. So, Michael, do you have any brilliant final thoughts to share with us?
I've never had such thoughts in my life, so it's unlikely to occur right now either.
Oh, but what if it were that time? This is your Nobel Prize winning moment.
Yeah, really. What I do want to say, though, not necessarily for the recording, but if you put it in, that's fine. I'm really impressed by the nature of the conversations you've been having, because what you're trying to do, in fact, what you are doing is so important. You're talking openly and honestly about complex issues, and you're doing it in a way that welcomes diverse opinions, welcomes difference, and models how we should be able to deal with people who don't necessarily agree with us. And whether we're talking about higher education or religious institutions, if in those settings we can't comfortably, intellectually, and civilly disagree with one another, what hope is there? If we all agreed on everything, life would be really boring. Disagreement is good. Disagreement is good, and we learn from each other. But to learn, we have to listen, and we have to respect, and we have to think, why are they saying that? There must be something that they know that I don't. Let me see if I can get into their head and appreciate what they're saying, even if they might be wrong. But if I can learn why they're saying that, maybe I'll think about things differently, or maybe I can better position myself to educate them, to show them why they are wrong, but not go in and assume that everything has to be a confrontation. And you guys seem to be able to do that, and seem to be doing that, not only in this podcast, but from the way you talk about your personal lives, your professional lives, you seem to be doing it with the people you interact with on a daily basis. And that's awfully impressive, and we need more people who are able and willing to take on that hard task. So I congratulate you for that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
May I make a request, Zach, and that humbled. I would like for that to stay in there. If that's okay with you, Michael, I think that would be a great way to end this episode with you on it, you know.
Right. Tell your friends. This has been episode 18 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. On behalf of all of our hosts, I want to again thank Dr. Michael Zimmerman for giving of his time to be with us. You can learn more about the Clergy Letter Project at theclergyletterproject.org. If you are a clergy person, please consider signing a letter. And if you're a member of a religious community, share it with your pastor or rabbi or priest or whatever they're called in your tradition. You can help get the letter to 20,000 signatures before the end of the year. You can find more information, show notes, and contact information for the podcast at downthewormhole.com. Next week, we dig deeper into how to communicate outside of our echo chambers, and Rachel tries to convince me that there's still hope for society. Speaking of, Dr. Zimmerman, if you could be one animal for a year, what would you be?
I really only know two animals well, one class of animal and one individual animal. The class of animal I know pretty well are bumblebees because I've studied them for many years, but they don't live that long, so it wouldn't work. So the other animal that I know well is sitting next to me. It's my dog, and she gets treated really well. So I guess I choose to be her for a while, especially if I could do it next to her, and then we could actually communicate, and I'd learn a whole lot more about the world around us. especially how smell works.